This is Art Moves. Art Moves is a series of curated conversations at the intersection of art, innovation, and social justice.
Each week, we'll be talking with the innovative thinkers and doers who are forging new ground in the creative arts or redefining what it means to be creative.
I'm Tony Williams.
And I'm Ilya Kislansky.
And we're your hosts for Art Moves. And today, Eli,
yes,
we're going to be talking to Tanisha Nash Laird. Now, I wanted to talk to this lady for a long time because I was first introduced to her through her LinkedIn page because it was so powerful and she's so engaged in many, many things. So we're really excited to have her. So, Tanisha, welcome to Art Moves.
Thank you so much for having me.
And where we want to start is, what kind of art moves you?
All kinds. I mean, multidisciplinary. I love music though. Music, absolutely. And I love experiencing visual art. But probably if I need a quick pick me up, it's music.
And what is it about music?
It's the emotion that is generated. You know, on the way here, I was listening to Donny Hathaway.
Ooh, yes.
I know. And I also associate music with memories and memories of family, my mother, you know, that sort of thing.
Right. You know, I listen to War, right? You know,
oh,
slipping into
War.
Darkness.
Yes.
And it just reminds me of so many things. But anyway, we're here to talk about you and not so much our memories, but then that'll be a piece of this as well. You are a tri-sector leader. And I think that's what Eli and I thought was just so impressive about you. You've been in business. You've been a leader of nonprofits and you've also been in government. So talk to us about, I want to know about your through line because right now you are the CEO and again, the CEO and president of the Greater Roxbury Art and Culture Center.
Yeah, the through line is probably community development. You know, now words like social impact are sort of what's in vogue. But I think anything that's about empowering people in the community is my through line. Yeah.
So talk to us a little bit about Newark Symphony Hall before we get into Roxbury, because that's where you are now. But you
that's
spent
right.
a few years at Newark Symphony Hall. So you want to talk to us about what that is, the history.
Yeah, Newark Symphony Hall is a near century old performing arts center. It was actually built by the Shriners, an order of the Masons, just like City Center mm-hmm. in New York. And then after the Great Depression became a concert hall. Everybody you could possibly think of went through Symphony Hall. Going all the way back to the 30s, I saw that the Metropolitan Opera wow. had started performing there and they were oversubscribed. They could not fit all the people that they wanted to fit. And the main concert hall was built with 3,500 seats. So this is a job that I actually fought for because when I was a child, mm-hmm. so memories again, I remember things live from Newark Symphony Hall on the radio, mostly WBLS. So that was why I wanted to be there. And so by the time I became president and CEO, it had been in significant disrepair. And so I remember having an interview and the search committee, which really thought they were hiring somebody to just, you know, sort of run and put on some programs. They said, what would you do? And I said, well, the first thing I would do is a capital improvement plan. And it turned out to be $50 million is what it turned out to be.
Did that intimidate you at all?
Not at all. You know,
it was for programming and the building?
No. That is just for the restoration of
the building.
That building.
Wow. Okay,
right. That building is a couple hundred thousand square feet. Again,
whoa.
To give you the scale.
Wow.
The concert hall was built with 3,500 seats, although now it has a little under 2,800 because, you know, we as a people have expanded. Those seats were a little smaller back then.
Isn't that check out the subways, right?
Right.
Larger people.
The Terrace Ballroom, which is also very famous, this has capacity of 1,200. And again, everybody you could possibly think of. And when I say that, I mean like every genre, right? So from American Songbook, Judy Garland, Frank Sinatra, jazz. Billie Holiday.
Yeah, Jackie Wilson right. over there, too.
Oh, yeah.
I remember that artist in particular.
The British Invasion. So all of those are things that were memories that I wanted people to be able to not only maintain, but to make new memories. So, yes, we embarked on a major capital campaign
So I have a couple of questions. So is there something that talks, some place where you talk about the history of this stuff, like an exhibit or something? Or
so, well, right? Thank you for asking that. So yeah. Yes, in particular, I wanted to focus on the Black and Latinx history of there, mainly because there wasn't any kind of repository, and that was the community that had really embraced it sort of the 60s on. Tito Puente Jr. had a show there in the ballroom. Celia Cruz, like a regular show that went on what is now, I think, Telemundo. But at the time, it was, you know, that UHF channel. So, yes, we did do a project to really capture that history. I engaged Guthrie Ramsey, who is an incredible musicologist at the time. He was at the University of Pennsylvania. And he did a project called The Soul of Newark Symphony Hall that was funded by the New Jersey Council for the Humanities. That's a great question.
That's great. Thank you. But in that time, there was an art scene. So one of the questions is, how does it change? You know, because you were there quite some time, right? How many years?
Yeah. So the neighborhood had changed. If you're talking about historically what that was like.
No, I'm talking about the art scene in Newark.
Oh, the art scene in Newark.
From the time you first started and from when you left.
Well, you know, I have to say, the mayor there, Mayor Raz Baraka, son of Amiri Baraka, formerly known as Leroy Jones.
Yeah.
He really has a passion. I mean, I think having a mayor who is also an artist sort of helped do all of the things. So anytime I would tell him about things that I was looking to do, he was not surprised, intimidated, didn't think it was a bad thing because, hey, some of those things he participated in. We had a Deaf Poetry was a show that was on HBO and MTV. We did a Deaf Poetry reunion there, and he and his father had been on the show. Unfortunately, we had to do it during the pandemic. We had to pivot to virtual, but we had Jill Scott and Malcolm Jamal Warner,
yes.
And all of these amazing people. So yes, a lot of amazing programming that we started to lean into. And then, you know, things like soul line dancing were perennial. And then we started a salsa night, a Latin night that Tito Puente Jr., the son, helped us kick off there. So a lot of incredible
programming.
So you
got a lot of legacy going on.
Lots of legacy. That was the through line for Newark Symphony Hall. It was about leaning into that legacy, especially for fundraising, right? So, yeah.
Now let's talk about MIST. This is a venue that you had was starting in Harlem or had started in Harlem.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about the MIST story.
So, you know, we partnered with developers that I had known. They were actually my clients when I was a marketing consultant, a Full Spectrum. They had developed a building called the Kalahari, and Carlton Brown, a Brooklynite, and Walter Edwards. They had said they wanted someone to partner with them to really run it because they're real estate developers. And so my husband and I, we were the operating partners. We were the minority owners, so 25%, but we were the operating people. He was the CEO. I was the chief marketing officer. And it was an amazing opportunity to, again, build something from the ground up.
How hard was it to raise funds for Newark Symphony Hall? I mean, you talked about the $50 million capital campaign project. Programming, how difficult was it?
So the thing that's sort of interesting is you mentioned earlier that I'm a tri-sector leader. And so those experiences really helped all of the projects that you've mentioned.
I would think so
far.
So, right?
Yeah. Because all of them had something in common. They were in communities that were considered distressed.
Exactly. Right.
And so there are tools now, thankfully, that allow you to raise money both from a public sector and the private sector. So on Wall Street, that includes getting people to invest in things called New Markets Tax Credit. So that's
what you knew about that.
I knew about that. I worked a New Markets Tax Credit project when I was a city official, and then MIST was funded by $21 million allocation of New Markets Tax Credits. Newark Symphony Hall was also something that we were going for, not only New Markets Tax Credits, but because it was historic, as in on the National Register of Historic Places, it also made us eligible for historic tax credits.
All right. Could you talk a little bit about what those are so people might not know?
Yeah, so they're incentives.
Including myself.
Right.
sitting here going, what?
I really wish more people knew about these tools.
No, it sounds amazing.
So it's funny because you talked about the different things I did. One of the things that I did and still occasionally do, I still have the consultancy, is that I work with people to show them how to access these tools. Mm. Because typically you have to have very expensive lawyers and big time consultants. But I know how to do it because I had to work with it. So
right, through economic development.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Economic development. So historic tax credits, it is once you're on what's called the National Register of Historic Places, which is done by the Park Service and the Department of Interior on the national level, you are eligible for these incentives. And it essentially gives you 20% of the total restoration value. So I'm just make up even numbers. Say it's a $100 million project. Let's go big. Mm-hmm. It's a $100 million project. That means you would be eligible for a $20 million credit. But you guys know what a credit means, right? What does that mean?
Basically, it means you have to make it and then get credited
exactly.
for it. Exactly. So you got to make it first. So, yeah.
So then, tough. So no, but then that's where Wall Street comes in.
Okay.
They monetize those tax credits. You can sell them.
Like an investment vehicle.
Emission tax credits. Things,
yeah, so it's,
like
an, it's, yeah. it's an investment vehicle. And so typically.
He went to Cooper Union.
I'll see. But I'm going to tell you why knowing all of these things were really important for me, even in a Newark Symphony Hall role. One of the ways that we really started to make money was leaning into film and television. Mm. And what was important on that is that we got, meaning the state of New Jersey, the film tax credit back.
Wow.
So people wanted to come into New Jersey to film. And there were also incentives for if you worked with diverse companies and if you did inclusionary hiring. So we leaned into that as well. And I was able to secure 7 figures in revenue just in one year just in renting out.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM.
Now, we've been talking a lot about Newark Symphony Hall and all the great things you did and how you basically came with a dynamite toolkit, you know, especially with that economic development piece. But now let's talk about what you're getting ready to, what you are embarking upon. You are now the president and CEO of the Greater Roxbury Art and Culture Center, and I'm from Boston, the Boston area. Just want to know why this move, why now?
So this one, they called me, right?
I got recruited for it.
Mm-hmm. It was someone, they were referred to me by someone who knew of MIST. She was at the Apollo when we were doing MIST. And I thought it was a consulting call. Like I said, people right. would call me and ask for advice.
I'm getting ready to do the same thing. Okay.
You are.
And it ended up being, you know, the one of the partners who is a retired Harvard Business School professor gave me a 10-minute speech as to why I should come. And so I was like, well, yeah, I have this 200,000 square foot thing. My largest theater is 3,000, and this theater is, how many seats is going to be in the main theater? 305.
At Roxbury.
Roxbury. But when he talked about what this would mean for Roxbury. So
what would it mean?
Is it okay to tell people we know each other outside
absolutely.
Of this, right? So
yes.
I am on the board where yes. you are an amazing chair
thank you.
The Billie Holiday Theater in Brooklyn, New York. And the Billie, though, is one of the few remaining theaters from that Black Arts movement.
Absolutely.
Think about
right.
that.
We're 50 years old.
50 this years week, old.
Yeah.
50 years
actually,
old.
Almost 51, actually.
Yeah, this year is 51. There aren't many venues left in Roxbury. So the idea of putting something back, especially during this time when they're trying to ban books, trying to change
yes.
history.
Mm.
That was one of the things where I was thinking, you know, here's an incredible opportunity. And I'm going to name drop. I'm going to shout out Richard Lawson. Richard Lawson is an incredible actor, stage and screen. When I was in high school, I had a crush on him because he was on Dynasty and he was romancing Diane Carroll. His character was right. Nick Chindle. I have forged a partnership with him and his wife, Miss Tina Knowles Lawson, known as the mother of Solange and Beyonce. And I was feeling a little guilty that I was considering taking this job when I'm in an active project.
But then you got Beyonce's mom on that side.
I recruited. For Newark. Actually, we had to turn Beyonce down. That's a really funny story. We had to turn her down at Newark Symphony Hall because we had graduations. And I'm glad I didn't officially knew. I knew unofficially. But anyway, I went back and told them, hey, I'm thinking of taking this role. And Richard said, Tanisha, they're not building places like this anymore. And that here's an incredible opportunity for you. And you will always be the first president and CEO of the Greater Roxbury.
So big time legacy right there.
Legacy.
But what's going to be in this center?
So that's what's so amazing. It's again going to be multidisciplinary. We're going to have performing arts. So that's dance, that's theater, that's music. We're going to have
visual arts.
There are two entrances. One is on Washington and the other is on Eustace. We're not saying there's no back door. There's two entrances, and both entrances will have art gallery space. So to be able to have this incredible space where we can really honor the people from the community. And I didn't mention this, but we are focused on, again, that's another theme, the Black and Latinx community. And it's the African diaspora. Boston, as you know, that area, lots of people coming from the Caribbean, from the motherland itself, from South America. And so to be able to have something that lifts up all of that, those diverse cultures is pretty awesome.
Now, is this going to be called Nubian Square? It was Dudley, right? It is now
called Nubian Square. Okay. So they changed the name, and the state actually designated that the Roxbury Cultural District. So there's, again, incredible opportunity to do some work. And there's a lot of work happening in Nubian Square. I mean, it's all about our project, but really there's a lot of great work that's happening there. And I'm excited about being there during this revitalization, if you will, of that neighborhood.
Are there other cultural institutions coming into that, or it must be
district? To my knowledge, no other nonprofit, but that's okay. I think the idea that there's commercial businesses, there's going to be a jazz club that's opening up there. That used to be a major jazz scene, just like Newark, major jazz scene. So I think the idea of putting these sort of things back into that community is really exciting.
How are you feeling about this entire momentous project? Meaning this is big to me, to my way. Yeah, this is very, very big.
Because you're fundamentally taken on by yourself.
Exactly.
To a large extent, right?
So I'm like,
right now,
who is this woman?
Right now,
who is
right
the superwoman?
I'm alone, but I'm not, right? So I'm the only person on payroll. But at the moment, I have to, again, start shouting out some of these, I call them skilled volunteers. I have a lawyer that is now in Virginia, and she's like, I'm from Roxbury. And right now, most of my volunteer work is at, a sort of homeless shelter and thing like that. And I'm not going to stop doing that, but I want to work with you. And so to be able to have all of those people coming to me, there's a fintech entrepreneur that is now going to be the first person on my emerging leaders. He just got his MBA, and he gave me a whole slew of people from, of course, Harvard and Tufts and MIT. It's not a bad place.
No, that's the wonderful place about Boston. It's such a huge college town.
Incredible. Northeastern is right there at Roxbury. So, yeah, there's a lot of opportunity.
Speaking from your economic development hat, though, meaning what are the kind, is this a workforce development initiative? Is this something that's going to
be? Absolutely. Ahead. So, once again, this idea of what they call stagecraft jobs, as you know. So that's the light, the sound, the grip, carpentry, all of those sort of things. Definitely want to get more local people engaged in that. There's going to be a lot of job creation, both in terms of the performing arts side, but also that technical side as well.
So the philanthropic environment in Newark and also in Boston must be quite different, I could imagine.
Very different. The tri-state area of New York, there are a lot of institutions that we'll go to. Boston, I have to say, there's a lot of individual wealth. So I have one donor who has donated $1 million, and it's a couple, and they're very excited. And to be able to be in dialogue with people like that who are, it's in my mind, it's a sort of investment, right? They're investing in this happening there. And I was really encouraged the first meeting that I had with them, because believe it or not, it wasn't actually this, the concept of it evolved over time. And so I sat down with them to make sure that they were still excited, and they absolutely are very excited. And, yeah, I feel good. And they're introducing me to their friends. So
you talked about the power, at least in some of the things that I've seen you write, you talk about the power of finding your network. Let's talk a little bit about what that means.
In addition to that, I wanted to add a little add on to that, mm-hmm. which is this idea of, like, if you were trying to generate funding for a project like this, you'd have to have design conversations for it.
Right.
Right. Which is part of it is also, it has come from the network.
Right. Exactly.
You know, what do those conversations look like for people who are not as experienced as you?
You know, that was one of the things that people were saying. They were like, how are you going to do this? You're going to a place that you don't know anybody. Mm-hmm. I'm going to tell you, there has not been a single event that I've been to, and I've been on this job for 3 months and 2 weeks, but who's counting?
Oh, wow. So like years, though.
Yeah. There has not been a single person that I've met who we didn't have somebody in common. And so that has been pretty great, because once you connect on that level, they're also very motivated to help you and to support you. And I'm really fortunate that these are people that are well respected in the community. And so I think, no, but I kind of feel like no matter, even if you don't feel you're highly networked, I'm going to acknowledge that I am highly networked, but even if you don't feel, you have a network, right? You have one. And to lean into that network, you know, when I give these talks mostly to emerging leaders, young professionals, and I have sort of this framework, right? The first is find your people, right? And then the second is be your own advocate. And the third is to be your own cheerleader.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM.
So talk to us about curating that network, curating that LinkedIn. How do you curate?
And also, how do you design the ask?
Well,
isn't that, doesn't sort of make
it? Yeah, it does. But let's get to the curate network and then
curate
design
first.
The ask. Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, I don't know how I curate my network. I'm just being honest. What I know is that I am very curious about people and I like connecting with people. Mm-hmm. And I also have kind of like a weird memory. So there are people that I've re-encountered after decades. And I would go, you know what? We met, you know, 22 years ago at an event. There's a very senior executive, for instance, at NBC. And I realized when she came, because one of the shows that we had at Newark Symphony Hall was an NBC show. I said, oh, my goodness, your maiden name is what? And I said, this whole time I was thinking I knew you. You and I volunteered at New Music Seminar in 1992.
Oh,
so
wow.
Actually 30 years ago. No. Yeah. So
sorry, my mom.
You know, oh, your mom's like that.
Well, she had an eidetic memory, or what they call a photographic memory.
I don't think I'm that great, but I'm
but you're good enough. I'm good enough.
You're lucky. Very tough to grow up with.
Yeah,
that.
I know. So there's that part, but I want to get to the ask, because that is something that I think people often do too soon.
Yeah, so it's not just the when, but it's also the structure.
What do you mean when you say too soon?
You know, it's...
Well, it's like dating.
Exactly. Yeah, right.
I love it.
It is like dating, but I wanted you to spell it out for those who just...
We're going to the...
Right. Yeah, so you might have a goal, and in this case, fundraising, right? So what I got to do now is all fundraising. The first thing you want to do is to really authentically connect with the people that you are going to
have. The word is authentically connect.
Yes, authentically connect. Mm-hmm. And finding those places of connection, right? Structuring the ask. So, you know, philanthropic fundraising, especially major gifts, there's a little bit of a science to it, too. There's that wealth screening that you do because you don't want to ask for too much. Mm-hmm. But you don't want to ask for too little, because if you ask for $100,000, but really they had the capacity for $2 million,
then you missed it. You missed the ask.
You missed your opportunity. Right. There's also this concept of seven touches. before you asked.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Ooh, that sounds interesting.
See, that you're learning something.
Yeah, yes, I am. I'm always learning. I am open to learning.
So the concept of seven touches is really like seven points of connection, right? It doesn't all have to be one-on-one. It could be email. It could be a letter. It could be, but you don't, I mean, if you just met somebody once, you don't want to ask them for something the next time you see them. That's why I even discourage people, because digital is very easy to ask for funds when you're doing like email. Even that, I think you probably don't want to aggressively ask. Now, to be clear, in my signature, I have a donate to us, but that's passive, right? That's
sure.
not a,
right.
And then there's one other thing, because I actually, there's a cause that I'm really passionate about. Well, if I was super passionate, I wouldn't have called this out to them, but I had given what I considered a major gift for me was $500, right? That was a major gift.
Come on,
right?
You got, yes.
Especially since it was an out of the blue gift.
Right.
It wasn't, you know, and nobody had contacted me.
Mm.
And I said to her,
well, it's a gift that you made.
It was a gift
and they didn't say
that
thank
I
you.
Made.
They didn't say
other
nothing,
than the automatic
right.
reply.
There no
was
good.
Reply.
No
but
good.
But if you see right. a person making a significant donation, and especially since I think this particular organization, that is a major gift for mm-hmm. them as well. And so the president of the nonprofit recently reached out to me. It's just someone I really like. And I said, hey, you know, I'm going to support you again, but I'm concerned that you are actually cultivating, first of all, thanking and cultivating your donors. I said, because I probably could have given a little bit more money to your subsequent campaigns if someone had just reached out to me. But I have a lot of choices.
It's interesting what you're saying. One, because I did donate to the thing, just mostly because of this great project, but also to see what the process was, to how do you acknowledge small donors? And it was great. So I want to acknowledge you for that. And the reason I want to bring that up is that organizations invariably fail in this area.
Absolutely.
Because they only look at and acknowledge the larger donors, but you really don't know who the small donors are. And first, why treat them differently?
So for instance, there is a person that I know who's huge capacity,
mm-hmm.
very wealthy, seven figure gift type wealthy. But I noticed something about him in terms of the way he gives. And I noticed that he really likes to, rather than just give black and women leaders a check, he actually puts them in good situations, right? One woman, he actually hosted a whole dinner at his home. Now, he has the kind of home where you could take the furniture out and put in banquet rounds, right? Like just in the living room,
yeah.
just in
wow,
the living room, right?
Wow.
It's a mansion. It's about
mm-hmm.
12,000, 13,000 square feet. And at that particular event, I made connections, and it wasn't even my event. I made connections. One of my friends, who is now covered Time Magazine twice, she's an artist. She got her first patron, her first benefactor, her first purchaser at that particular function. But I knew that he's not a person that I would ever ask a big gift from, because just knowing him gives me access. And what was mm-hmm. interesting is I found out that same person that he threw this big event for, she then asked him for a gift of, I want to say $10,000. And it wasn't that he couldn't afford it. He clearly spent way more than that
right.
on that event that he did for
right.
her. So it was just kind of like knowing.
It's being emotionally intelligent.
Well, it's also listening, too. Not
exactly.
just listening, like listening to the voice and stuff, but also listening to the environment, who mm-hmm. this person is.
And understanding what is the motivation. And understanding, and he always laughs me off the phone when I go, just telling people I know you gets me into doors, you know. But it's true. It really is true. And
the
so
best donors.
And though those yeah. are the types of things that you want to read, you want to find it, figure out. It's just like if you're putting a board together, sometimes people put people on boards they know are never going to come to a board meeting, but they're going to write a big check.
Well, we're going to have to wrap, but
yes.
you've brought so much to this conversation, Tanisha, and I am hoping that there are many people after hearing this particular radio show will donate to
the
Greater
Roxbury?
The
Greater Roxbury Arts and Culture Center. You can find us at GROC, GRACC Boston, no space or anything, .org. So grocboston.org. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Art Moves is co-produced by Brick Arts Media and pre-recorded at Brick Studio in downtown Brooklyn.
This has been Art Moves with your hosts, Tony Williams and Eli Kozlansky. Find some art that moves you and share it with someone.